WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Tuesdays at about this time, Charles Hardy features his popular culture series. And the subject today is the subject of oral history, a way of going about studying the past, which has almost helped us to reevaluate what's important in the past.
Today's program is going to be on something called oral history, a technique of historical research that has recently been receiving a good deal of academic and popular attention. Now, the subject of this series has been on different aspects of American popular culture. We've had programs on detectives, television, novels of various ilks, gambling, all of which are entertainments and activities associated with American culture. And oral history may seem a bit removed from these other topics, but it does have a great deal in common with them, reflecting both popular and academic interests, and is also an important tool of popular culture studies. As practiced today, oral history is a technique only a few decades old, as it hinges upon the use of the tape recorder. And to date, its chief contribution, it seems to me, has been in the concern of many of its practitioners with the recording and the interpretation of the life experiences of large segments and subgroups of the American population who have traditionally been excluded from historical studies, indeed often from history itself. Oral history as a field has grown along with the study of popular culture and women's, black, and ethnic studies as part of the major academic and indeed broader social movement to re-enfranchise these groups into the American world. Pluralism is one popular term for this new vision. The spreading interest in oral history, too, is illustrative of a renewed national interest in the past as a source of identity and of values grounded in the actual historical experiences of America's different peoples. It is in part, too, a combat against the popular media, notably ahistorical in their content and thinking. To get a better understanding of what this whole field of oral history is, I spoke to Mike Frisch, a professor of history at the University of Buffalo, who is presently a research associate at the Center for Philadelphia Studies at the University of Pennsylvania. The first question I asked Mike was for a definition of oral history.
Well, I think like many forms of historical research, it's a pretty broad umbrella under which many things can be sheltered. If you're looking for a definition, I think probably the best I've ever come across is the idea that oral history is a kind of historical research in which the researcher is creating the documents that he's studying through an active interaction with the sources. I mean, usually one goes and reads something or finds a document that happened in the past, and then one studies it in the present. In oral history, the document actually doesn't exist until there's an interaction between the historian and a potential source through the form of an interview. Beyond that, which really just describes the process, oral history can cover so many things, from informal reminiscences, from an attempt to get the spirit of a bygone age, whether it's the frontier experience in a small town in some unsettled area, or the debriefing of a decision maker. And really, those are very, very different kinds of things. To ask a former Secretary of State exactly what did you say, you know, at the summit conference just before the Russian ambassador walked out is one type of question. To ask somebody else what did it feel like going from Oklahoma to California, in the Dust Bowl days, is a very different kinds of thing. We call them both oral history because they both can be elicited through interviews. But essentially, I would say that the methodological focus, the idea of actually going to live sources and asking them a variety of questions about what happened and what it meant and what they think about it, is the essence of what currently is being called oral history.
Historians have always done this, though, haven't they? Gone to the people who had actually had the life experiences that are being studied.
Well, yes
or
and
lived
no.
Through events. I'm leading as a why has the term oral history come up in the last?
Well,
10,
for several
years?
Reasons. One is that I think there's far more of a historians have often done interviews in the same way the journalists do interviews. The interviews were often very specifically directed at a particular problem. Let's say that an historian was working on, again, the ambassador question. Example that I gave is probably the best kind of example of that. What has become more interesting to people and has been called oral history is the notion of creating not so much to answer a specific question in the course of an ongoing research project, but to use the oral method while people are still available to be interviewed to assemble essentially an archive of information, of historical information, which can be used in other researches as yet, you know, unanticipated. This really probably was set mostly at Columbia University in the project devised by Alan Nevins, where essentially the insight in the 40s and 50s was that in the modern age, people don't write as many letters. We're not going to have the kinds of documentary collections for decision makers that we are used to relying on for historical research. So before people die, we might as well sit them down and find out everything they might want to say that might be of interest to somebody later. This was done, you might say, from the top down with the program at Columbia, which was basically a kind of elite interviewing program. In other ways, it was done from the bottom up, from a very similar point of view, a very similar insight in the slave narratives collected by the WPA. These weren't done on tape for the most part, but again, the idea was the same, that future historians will be interested in what these people had to say. At that point in the 30s, it was realized that the generation of people who actually had been slaves, you know, freed by the Civil War, would, of course, all be, they were quite aged then and would all be passing from the scene within the next 10 or 20 years. So if we didn't get them now and find out what they had to say, what they remembered, what they might want to pass on, then there would be no chance to do that. And of course, these were not people who generally wrote diaries or extensive memoirs or had letter collections that were likely to end up in the Library of Congress either. So I think what has generated this newer interest in urban history as opposed to older historical journalism is the idea of assembling in advance a less topically focused and more generally useful historical archive of people's experiences, memories, and so forth that can provide a data bank and a resource bank and a vast pool of historical information, reminiscences, opinions, and experiences that we can all be enriched by in looking them over in the years to come.
What's the value of this? You know, assembling all of these interviews?
Well, the value is, in one sense, archival, in that we will have, again, as with the slave narratives is a perfect example of that, or the debriefing of a Secretary of State. In future years, it may become very important. People may want to. We take a lot of things for granted. I know I first got into oral history through interviewing my grandparents, particularly my grandfather, and I remember it occurred to me at that time that I had grown up as the grandson of immigrants, with full familiarity with the immigrant experience. Those accents were part of what I heard every day, the stories of the old country and so forth. And I realized that on some level, perhaps not so significant, my children and my grandchildren would not have any of that accessible to them. They would not hear these accents, and they would certainly not hear stories and hear reports about a world that had, taken place under very, very different circumstances from what surrounded them. So I was interested in recording some of that simply for personal and family reasons. And I think in many senses the impulse to oral history has been no more complicated than that for many people. It's the sense that there's a very rich body of experience that people carry with them in their lives, and that very few people in the world leave without the assistance of something like this. Very few people leave comprehensive records of that, usually, and in fact, usually those people are only very wealthy and powerful people who happen to be interviewed, who happen to have archives, who happen to write letters all the time that are collected in some important place. And for most of the rest of us, the experience just passes away and is not carried forth. And as the pace of change accelerates very quickly from generation to generation, so that the world that one generation lives in is going to be vastly different than that their parents, much less their grandparents, much less their great-great-grandparents lived in. It will be much harder increasingly to retrieve some sense of what things felt like, what they look like, and the details themselves in terms of important historical events. And that, combined with the accessibility of the tape recorder, and really it's a kind of democratizing device in that sense. It's not that hard to operate. It really opened to many people the possibility of assembling this kind of historical record in their own families, in their communities, in their neighborhoods, and so forth, has really encouraged this sense that we can preserve this material now while the people are still here. We can interact with them. We can talk about their lives and the experiences that they've had, and this will become a very valuable record for future generations. And in that sense, the impulse is like, I think, doing any history, that it's good to know about things. And in some ways, our own world is made richer by having a sense of where we came from and what went before us.
Now that you've heard some of the background and theory, this seems an appropriate time to listen to a short section of an oral history interview, this one with a Philadelphia Union activist, from a tape on deposit at the Urban Archives at Temple University.
I had my first taste of a labor conflict when I was living on 11th Street. This was when the trolley workers went out on strike. I don't remember whether it was 1906 or 1905, but it was somewhere within that time period. Mm-hmm. And they called out the state police. And we were playing, and children were playing on the street when we saw people gathering. And we didn't pay any attention to it until we saw people, men gathering and talking, you know, we'll get them, we'll tell them what it is, you know. And they were, we didn't pay any. All of a sudden, we heard the trolley car coming, and the men formed a line across the street. And as they did that, the Pennsylvania Mounted Police, they were then called the Pennsylvania Cossacks. They had the high hats with the clubs, billy clubs, and on their horses. And I saw them, my first charge of police into a labor group. And they really ran roughshod over them.
Just ran over them, the horses?
They were pushing and shoving many people. I saw many workers and many policemen were laid out. Mm-hmm. Not that they're killed, you know, mm-hmm. but just injured. Mm-hmm. When I showed, we dispersed. I would tell you that in the 1929 strike, that is the organizational strike here, although the union itself was established in 1914, but it took all these years to finally crack the hard nut that was Philadelphia. During the 1929 strike, you know that people threw themselves in front of trucks, didn't want to let them pass. And what was happening was, it was happening all over the country, was the, as I understand it, now I have no proof of what I'm going to say, but these things actually happen, so we're pretty well sure what we're saying, that there was a racket developed. A teamster would buy a truck, make an arrangement with some contractor in a country, and he'd go to New York or to Philadelphia and say, look, for so much and so much, I would have a garment made up for you, which was much less than what the union was demanding, mm-hmm. always paying, you know. Mm-hmm. So the manufacturer, in order to stop the union, said, okay, he wanted his work done, and he couldn't get it done in his plant. So he didn't even know where his merchandise was going. In other words, he lost all control of his merchandise until he'd come back to him. Mm-hmm. So naturally, it came to the ears of the union officials, and they asked for volunteers, and they got plenty that actually threw themselves in front of trucks to prevent them from leaving plants. Mm. And the thing, we went out and we organized, we walked picket lines, we canvassed homes at night. I was threatened many a times. If you don't do this, you're gonna, if you don't lay off, you know, this is gonna happen. And
were you frightened?
I sometimes wonder if I had brains enough to be frightened.
It was more important than fear.
You know, it's just, it's hard to describe the feeling that you go through. It becomes a crusade.
The tape recorder has been an invention of tremendous influence on our culture, part of the technological revolution in communications media in the 19th and 20th centuries, that has resulted in, among other things, an informational explosion in which the amount of stored information has increased exponentially, while means of retrieval, interpretation, and use have lagged farther and farther behind. The effects this overload has had upon American culture are profound. We all know of the vast increase in material students must master in high school and college, and how all of this information has led to highly segmented specialization. Ironically, it has also contributed directly to Americans' loss of knowledge and interest in their past. The use of the tape recorder in oral history puts another twist into the picture, as along with videotape, it is a medium with tremendous potential for the decentralization of information and knowledge. It's inexpensive, it's easy to use, readily available, and in its use, to preserve the memories, thoughts, and life experiences of previously silent groups, it gives them a voice previously unknown. The new options the tape recorder offers was the next issue we discussed.
In its modern form, oral history was largely influenced by traditional historical research at the very beginning, and the Columbia Project, again, is the best example of that. In research like that, I guess you're interested in, for the most part, the particular experiences that important people, decision makers, or others have had. I would say, by and large, now the bulk of interest in oral history, particularly in its more widespread forms in local communities and historical societies and classrooms, in families and so forth, that the interest has been less in getting at that particular historical event and more at trying to get a generalized picture of what the immigrant experience was like or what a working-class neighborhood was like at a period of change. And that here, the sense is very much that we can get a view of this from the people themselves that may be very different than the images that have come down to us through the sources that historians have usually depended on, which have often been, you know, one insightful novelist or a particular poet or a documentary photographer. Well, these are all valuable in their own way, but somehow they're all filtered and they're all, you know, a viewpoint from a certain kind of perspective so that we can get a very different view and perhaps a more authentic view in some ways by talking to the people themselves who actually lived through the experience.
In many ways, it's a more intimate picture. It sort of establishes the bonds. I was just thinking it establishes the bonds on a one-to-one basis or, you know, with an actual person's life experiences instead of in great generalities about this many million people came at this point
of
time and they settled in these areas and then they moved up.
That's right.
Some social scientists or social scholars have been talking recently about the American Victorian neurosis was sex. This was the topic that was least discussed or had the greatest number of taboos, and that in modern America it's much more death or the sense of passage of time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think just from teaching, you know, introductory history courses in college, that the undergraduate or high school students do have a great deal of difficulty or they're unfamiliar with the whole feeling of what, you know, the experiential or effective feeling of history
mm-hmm.
and what it means and represents.
Well, and that's true. And certainly, I mean, this gets to a whole other dimension, I think, of the current interest in oral history, which is that the process itself is a valuable thing for people to do. In some ways, it's often been observed that it's an artificial way to do what in the past perhaps happened more naturally, to have young people talk to their grandparents, to have people in a community talk to the elders in the community at a time now, you know, where so many of our living situations are kind of age segregated. People grow up in suburbs where there are very few older people who are all back in the old neighborhood or perhaps in a senior citizen's home and so forth. Families are often more fragmented, and many young people can go through their entire lives living largely with people of their own age. They go to school and they live mostly in their peer group as they, you know, leave high school. They go to college and they're living in dormitories or in apartment